From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. When Meredith Scardino pitched her musical comedy series, Girls 5 Eva, about an all but forgotten late 90s girl group that reunites in their 40s, she made a fake CD case complete with cellophane wrapper and discount stickers. The title, World Domination.
But World Domination with periods because it stands for We Are Outstanding Living Dolls Dancing Our Music Into... Wait. Today, it ends in with Today in Our Nation.
Now a buzzy new show for Peacock, Girls 5 Eva, is full of songs that might stick in your head, not forever, but 5 Eva. Scardino tells us about working in late night with Stephen Colbert, where she was often the only woman in the room, to running her own show. While production on Girls 5 Eva didn't quite go as planned due to the pandemic, Scardino tells us how she adapted the script, including setting a performance in an abandoned mannequin warehouse. Hey, she needed the bodies. But first on the news banter, AT&T makes a discovery. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I'm joined by my companion in banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So on Sunday, that's May 16th, Sunday, we get word that AT&T, having had what I think has to be considered an epic failure with the Warner Media assets, all of those really glorious Hollywood assets, HBO, Warner Brothers Film and TV Studio, Turner, CNN, having had this notion that they were going to somehow put this through the telephone company, broadband, whatever, however it's supposed to work, they realize that they are not suited for this business, I guess. They realize that they're not going to be able or willing to spend the billions to get HBO Max, the streaming service, to be a real competitor in the brutal world of streaming. And suddenly we're hearing that there's this deal with Discovery. Behind the scenes, there is John Malone, the 80-year-old genius of the media world, who is known for creating these really complicated tax arrangements. They put together this deal, which I won't pretend to understand, but the bottom line is David Zaslav of Discovery, a guy who has no real scripted background, is now atop this gigantic empire that consists not only of the Discovery channels and streaming service, but Warner's and all of their stuff. He is now running it. And as I like to say, he would have been perceived as this interloper. You know, Hollywood always kills anybody who's even a sort of an outsider. So with all that reality and his background over the years, they would have normally, the town and the Warners would turn on him. But they were so miserable. Everyone was so unhappy with AT&T and the moves they made and the brief tenure of Jason Kyler running Warner Media, that I think they're just like closing their eyes, crossing their fingers, and hoping for the best.
Yeah, and first let's talk about the colossal, utter, historic failure of AT&T's forays into the media business. I mean, they managed to lose tens of millions of dollars, not on one company, but two. Because don't forget, they bought DirecTV in 2015, right as the cord-cutting phenomenon really picked up. And they ended up having to spin that off, tens of millions of dollars of value lost. And then these Warner Media assets, which they picked up from Jeff Bukas, who sold it for $85 billion 3 years ago. Now they're spinning it off with Discovery. And the value of the enterprise is probably almost half of that, at least depending on who you believe. This is just an amazing rebuke of both Randall Stephenson, the previous CEO, John Stankey, the current CEO, who was head of strategy when they did these deals. Just an amazing failure and yet entirely predictable. I mean, people were saying from the very beginning, this dream of melding content with distribution has never worked. It didn't work for AOL, did not work for Verizon, and it did not work for AT&T. It was a mismatch of cultures. It was a problem in hiring. They should not have brought in someone like Jason Kyler, who doesn't understand the creative community. And they just one after another kept making bad decisions where ultimately, I guess the only good decision they made was recognizing it was a failure and getting out.
I don't know that there weren't people pressuring them. You know, they have dissident shareholders and things like that pushing them very hard. So yes, and really it was the March of Folly. Now, David Zaslav, I didn't know much about David Zaslav coming into this. I mean, I knew he was an extraordinarily, insanely compensated guy at Discovery, making multiples of, at one point, of what Bob Iger was making for running Disney. He, I have learned since, is a guy who is a very tough boss. He's based on the East Coast most. He's had his executives here attending 5 a.m. meetings on the regular for a long time. He grinds content providers, people who make shows for Discovery. You know, at Discovery, among many reality producers, is considered a last stop because they know, you know, I was told by a lot of people who used to work there, because there are a lot, because the turnover is high, that, you know, he will, if you've got a thing built into your deal for a bump up for in compensation in a second season, they'll just say, well, sorry, we can't do it, while he was collecting all this money. So he is a very tough boss. Normally, as I said, Hollywood would not welcome him. But in this moment of having been through traumatic times where, you know, Warner's infamously put all of the 2021 movies day and date with the streamer without telling any of the creative partners, and there's a lot still backlash for that, you know, that needs a reset. And they had just, you know, not meshed with this industry. They're hoping at least this guy, who's very much in the old boy network, you know, he does these regular Zoom calls with, you know, Jeff Zucker, who now looks like he will stick around at CNN, maybe, because they are such besties and golf buddies with people like Irving Azoff, the music mogul, or this Goldman Sachs guy, Lloyd Blankfein. All of these guys get on Zoom calls and chat and get together. All of them, I will note, are white men. I'm sorry, ladies, but they're still doing this stuff on the golf course. But he is not exactly, it's somebody you might say, let's take this company into the future, but he's the guy who's going to, I think people are hoping, restore luster to Warner's.
And he's saying all the right things. I mean, he is very clear in his initial interviews talking about the value of the film studio, which was somewhat neglected under AT&T. He's talking about the creative relationships. He called Toby Emmerich, the film studio chief, personally, and he's talking about getting together socially. Like, he's doing the right things to try to repair this. But a friend of mine at Warner Brothers said to me the other day, you know, I don't want to say that it can't get worse, because it can always get worse, but we feel that it really can't get worse. So anything is going to be better. You know, you don't do a merger and then add jobs typically. You usually cut them, and that's probably going to be the next thing.
They definitely will, yes. They've talked about a lot of cutting, yeah.
And, you know, this culture clash, I mean, HBO especially still considers itself to be better than other networks and a better place to work and doing the highbrow Emmy-winning stuff. Now it's going to be run by the provider of Dr. Pimple Popper and Honey Boo Boo and all of these shows that are not on the same level of creative aspiration. I mean, they're fine for what they are, but I think people at HBO would not want to take notes from someone whose experience is that kind of content.
Yeah, and he is known, as I said, as a tight-fisted manager. And I noted in the Hollywood Reporter piece I did, you know, they just announced at Discovery they're doing Game of Thrones with otters, which led some of my people to speculate, my sources, to say, what would he have thought about the real Game of Thrones? A huge gamble, a huge roll of the dice. And he does spend on certain things that he really wants, but that's not the usual way. And it's just going to be a tremendous change of pace for him to be confronted with, like, you know, here's a $250, $300 million movie. What do you think? And I assume Toby Emmerich survives, although there had been a perception and with this previous regime now that maybe he wouldn't. Toby Emmerich survives a lot. He may yet again, because he is on those Zoom calls. He manages very well with managers, with people who are wealthy, older men. He's got a whole array of friends like that. This is Toby Emmerich's world. And he and Jeff Zucker may still be there, notwithstanding the fact that Jeff Zucker had said he was leaving at the end of the year. It was very clear he didn't care for Jason Kyler and it was going to be a him or me situation. And it turns out it may be, it's certainly not going to be Jason Kyler, and Zucker may stick around.
Yeah, the kind of legacy old media guys clearly won out here. Remains to be seen whether they are the best to shepherd these companies into the future.
Yeah, especially since they're, you know, a specific kind of legacy media person. But we'll see. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany. He is now founding partner of a new and still unnamed media company. Congratulations, Matt.
Thank you. I'm also doing an email that I'm sending out to insiders. If you'd like to subscribe, you can go to my Twitter, Matt Bellany, M-A-T-T-B-E-L-L-O-N-I, and find out how. Thanks.
In the new Peacock comedy, Girls 5 Eva, a one-hit wonder 90s girl group gets a 21st century opportunity when a rapper named Lil Stinky, played by Jeremiah Kraft, decides to sample one of their tracks in a new song.
Oh, yeah. They were a thing for a second back around 99, 2000. Remember them, Lil Stinky?
No, it was a baby in 99. Ask smarter questions, Paul. But I like it. It's old school.
All the members of Girls 5 Eva, played in modern times by Sarah Bareilles, Renee Elise Goldsberry, Paul LaPelle, and Busy Phillips, have struggled in the years after their brief brush with fame. They've fallen out of touch, and they're now four instead of five, as we're told one member of the group perished in a tragic accident involving swimming over the edge of an infinity pool. When Girls 5 Eva decides to reunite, one member of the group, Gloria, who's become a dentist, tries to temper their expectations. Gloria is played by veteran SNL writer Paul LaPelle.
Well, strap in. Four grown ladies trying to be pop stars. Get ready for the same amount of respect I get when I'm riding my recumbent bike. People throw fountain sodas at me.
No. Girls 5 Eva is produced by Tina Fey and Robert Carlock, the duo behind 30 Rock and The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt. Our guest Meredith Scardino was a writer on that show and Mr. Mayor before creating Girls 5 Eva. We talked to Scardino from her home in New York, and you may hear occasional sounds of the city. Scardino set out to be an artist and went to Parsons to study painting, but she always had an interest in comedy.
I mean, I was like obsessed with SNL and watched stand up incessantly. And I think when I was 7 or something, I wrote SNL a letter. I was like, you know, it'd be a great idea if a layman hosted. And if that layman was a 7-year-old girl from Pennsylvania.
That's so adorable. Wait, I need to know if they wrote back at all. Did you get at least a form letter?
Sure, it was just thrown into a canyon. You know, I think my first art class I ever took was a cartooning class. So I always loved the intersection of like jokes and art. So when I got to New York, I started taking improv classes. I started animating to make money because I knew flash animation. And eventually I landed a job at Best Week Ever on VH1. That was my first real writing job. I did that. And then I worked at Letterman. And then I worked at the Colbert Report. And then jumped over to Kimmy Schmidt. And then it's now. And I did Girls 5 Eva.
Well, let's just pause on that late night thing, because, of course, people always want to talk about the only woman in the room.
I was the only woman at a couple shows. And people just took it at face value. Who's applying? And there were very few women applying for these jobs. I don't know why. I just know from, you know, talking to people about the amount of submissions they'd get, they really didn't get a lot from women. They would get, you know, less than 20%, maybe even less than 10%.
Well, it's kind of a self-perpetuating thing, right? Because there's this
it is
there that it's really uncomfortable and the guys aren't nice to you. And, you know, books have been written about that.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't think it was the most inviting space, you know, for women. Anyway, so, but I got in there, and I think now that people seek out a well-rounded room in a way that they didn't before. I think they would just take whoever applied. They'd read them. A lot of times they read them blind. And then if it turned out to be all white guys, that's what you got, you know? And I think people are just being so much more mindful of like, we need more perspectives in the room, you know, and looking elsewhere for talent and encouraging people to apply for these things that don't even know about it. So I think it has shifted a lot in a positive way.
Did you have to fight battles and, you know, or get left out of things?
I was the only woman at Letterman and at Colbert for part of the time. But I had like the most wonderful time at the Colbert Report. Stephen is the most generous, wonderful person ever. I felt more like an outsider, I think, at Letterman because just the environment wasn't quite as sunny and warm.
Yes, we've had a guest on the show talk about that at some length. So, I know the reputation and Dave is very distant and whatnot. So, you know.
I think it's fun to also work on shows that are new, because I think when you do anything for 20 years, everything's sort of set in place with the way you do things. And so I feel like you have more of a presence in a room when you start building it from the ground up. So I really like working on shows that are just getting going. So it was great coming in on the Colbert Report, which just kind of been around for about a year and a half, I think, when I started. So you really, I really felt like I could have a lot of say and be really listened to and a contributor, which was great.
Oh, great. Yeah. What a great show. Yeah. So you go into scripted, I think, on Kimmy Schmidt, right?
Yes. That was when I made the jump, going
and,
from
I mean,
the Colbert
was that,
to scripted.
Yeah. I mean, what was that transition like?
Well, that was one of these things where I was having such a great time on the Colbert Report, but I didn't know how long it would last. And I'd also been doing it for 6 years. So just as far as finding new moves and stretching myself, I was a little bit ready for something. And then I read the pilot for Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, which was called Tooken at the time. And I thought it was the funniest thing I'd ever read. I was so excited by it. And I thought, if there's ever a project I would leave this job that I love for, it would be this. Because, you know, I've been a long time admirer and fan of Tina and Robert. And it just felt like this was it. This was the thing to go for. And I was very happy when they hired me.
Yeah. And so then us begins the whole new phase. When did you start thinking about this idea? I know it's something about the reuniting of these 90s pop groups was what this, I think, was the germ of the idea.
Yeah. So I think around the Kimmy Schmidt Interactive, I had started trying to think seriously about what show I would want to develop. And I had a few things I was trying to do. Like, I wanted to be able to write about experiences being a 40-year-old, some-year-old woman in New York. And then I came across news stories about a bunch of, you know, girl and boy groups reuniting. And I thought, you know, all the lights went off in my head. And I thought, oh, well, this is really interesting, because then you can also talk about what happened back in the late 90s, early 2000s, which was a time when I was, you know, 18 or around 18 or 20. And so then you can kind of talk about your life in the past and also talk about life now and set it all against the hyperbolic world of pop music. And it just felt very fertile to me that it was a group of basically strangers that were thrown together and went through this really crazy experience that they thought was going to last forever, but it, you know, they were just on to the new thing, the next shiny thing, and it wasn't them. And so then what does it look like when you're spit out and then you have to like pick up the pieces of your life? And what did that look like for these women in the wake of the group ending?
So you were sort of part of the NBC Universal family at that point, right?
I was on a development deal with them. It was within Universal. But I had to pitch it to everybody. So my first order of business was pitching it to Tina and Robert. I went in with the idea, pitched them roughly the characters, and they bid on it and were into it, gave me a few thoughts. Then I got the pitch ready. I can't remember the exact list, but I feel like we pitched like 10 places.
Right.
I was happy to find a partner that was willing to go straight to series and make it. And Peacock was just on board and was like, yeah, we'll give you episodes. So we're like, let's do it.
I read where you made a CD.
I did. I made a prop.
You made a prop.
This is where my art school background came in handy. Like, I made a whole fake album. It was a CD, and it had ladies on the cover, and the title of the album was World Domination, but it's World Domination with periods because it stands for We Are Outstanding Living Dolls Dancing Our Music Into Wait. Today it ends in with today in our nation. This is today absurd. But anyway.
Okay. It works. I get
it. So I went in with that, and I had on the back a track list. Some of the songs we ended up doing.
Did you just make up names of songs randomly?
Yeah, I made up names of the songs. Like, I think My Eyes Are Bluer When I Cry was one. I think the Dream Girlfriends was called Don't Worry, and then in parentheses, Our Dads Are Dead.
Oh, God.
I had one called Lyrics TK. Like, I just pictured these ladies went through a factory and just were just given songs they had lying around, that it wasn't put together with the most care. And then I needed a CD for the feel of the heft. So I looked around. I think I had the Jack Lemmon collection DVD. set. So I put one of those in there, but then I didn't want the executives to open it because then they would see a Jack Lemmon DVD. So then I bought the cellophane that you can wrap things in, but then you have to also, I also had to buy this hairdryer, industrial hairdryer thing that makes the plastic melt around it.
I was wondering about that, to be honest, because I read that it was cellophane wrapped and I thought I wouldn't know how to wrap something cellophane, but
yeah.
Go on.
And I even packed it in my suitcase when I went to LA and I was doing it in a hotel room the night before.
What, you tucked the hair dryer and the whole thing?
Yeah, I had the whole thing. And then I also had like a Sam Goody sticker with a barcode, and it was originally priced at like, you know, $16.99 or something like that. And then I had a bunch of discount stickers on top to show you that it had stuck around for a while and ended up being a dollar eventually.
So you hand this around when you're doing your pitch. Did anybody try to open it?
Some people were like, thanks. So I keep this. I'm like, no, you don't keep this. I got to take that to the next pitch.
Don't touch it. Don't unwrap it. Give it back.
Just look at it. Give it back.
Coming up after a short break, Girls 5 Eva creator Meredith Scardino shares the origins of the memorable song, New York Lonely Boy. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Meredith Scardino, creator of the new Peacock series, Girls 5 Eva. The musical comedy follows the reunion of Girls 5 Eva, an all-but-forgotten 90s group that decides to attempt a comeback. This time around, the members of Girls 5 Eva decide they have to write their own songs, as they come to realize that some of the material they were given the first time around may not have had the girl power message they once thought it did. The members of Girls 5 Eva are played by two real-life Broadway stars, Sarah Bareilles and Renee Elise Goldsberry. Rounding out the group are former SNL writer Paul Appel and Freaks and Geeks alum Busy Phillips. Those two are not known for their singing, but Scardino says they can and do.
Well, when I pitched the show, you know, we all thought, oh, well, look, you know, we really only need to find one actress who can sing as well. And the rest can, you know, maybe one holds a tune, maybe one just claps. You know, they don't have to be incredible. But then we just kept getting talent that could do everything. So the first person we went out to was Sarah Bareilles. And we felt like it was a swing because we didn't know if she would want to do this show. But Tina had seen her in Waitress, and Tina was like this, she's so natural. Her timing is great. She's a really, really good actress. So we took a swing and went to her and she said yes. And then because she said yes, we felt like, okay, well, let's find more of the most amazing people. And the next person we went to was Renee, who obviously everyone knows from Hamilton, but Tina had an inside hot tip from working with her on the movie Sisters. Renee's scene eventually, unfortunately, got cut out. I think they shot way too much footage. But they said she's really funny. So we went to her next and she wanted to do it. And then Paula and Busy kind of came together as we got closer and closer to shooting. Both of them were living in LA and, you know, Paula was on AP Bio. And I just didn't really think it was possible that they would end up on a New York City show. But Busy had coincidentally decided to move east. And so Tina called her and said, hey, you're moving east, huh? I got a job you might be interested in. And she was immediately, which was great. And then Paula happened to be kind of waiting out the pandemic in North Carolina. And she also was like, yeah, I'm in. I'm East Coast. I'm in. So we just got the best cast.
I mean, I don't know if you had those broad types in your head before, or you let the cast somewhat shape the types of the women in the pop group.
Well, we had the parts written. We did, however, once we got our cast, try to write more to them and also learn their strengths. Sarah is a super funny physical comedian, and she's also just got wonderful timing. And Renee you know, in the pilot, there's a line that she just bursts into song.
I thought this little stink of stuff was going to be my ticket back to the fame and the lifestyle I am owed because of the voice God put in my mouth.
And so we started writing more punchlines for her where she gets to sing them.
Right. That's like a little shtick that she has. Yeah.
So finding those little things and then writing towards them was very fun.
And then, of course, you plunge into shooting a whole thing in the middle of the pandemic, which I didn't understand how this came to be. And then I read that you shot in the pandemic and I'm like, I don't know how it was executed.
Every day was problem solving. For example, the scene in episode 104, Karma, their little Bible study was initially a mega church. And so we said, well, we can't shoot a mega church. So then it became a Bible study, which worked just as well. But there were things like that. You know, we have in episode 6, they play a club show in Brooklyn. And we're like, how are we going to, I don't know what to do. I don't know how to get a lot of bodies in here. We can't. So we ended up writing it that it takes place in an abandoned mannequin warehouse. So at least we had some bodies populating some of the reverse shots from the audience. But yeah, it was really challenging, but everyone really rose to the challenge every day.
Well, I would feel like remiss not talking about New York Lonely Boy before we conclude this, because that is, I think that's the moment when I went from like to love, because it's so brilliant.
Yeah.
And that was a thing,
a
thing that you had in your life.
You know, it was an expression I made up to describe my son, because a lot of people in New York wait a long time to have a kid. And then a lot of them are one and done. But I just sort of noticed a lot of these sophisticated little gentlemen walking around with 40-year-old parents around the city. And so then when I had a son, and sometimes people would ask me, like, are you going to have another one? And I go, no, he's just a New York lonely boy. Talk about him that way. And it just kind of organically came up that we were looking for a story for Dawn to talk about, like, how this group is being a real wrench thrown into the plans of her home life. And we thought a second baby was probably on the list. It just organically came out that, oh, how fun it would be to be able to talk about this concept of a New York lonely boy. And another writer in the room, Lauren Gerganis, she and I had babies, our sons, within 2 weeks of each other. And so we would just always refer to our sons as New York lonely boys. And then another writer on the series, Michael Komen, I think he was the one that said something about, oh, you always see him high-fiving a doorman. And I was like, yes, that's exactly what you see happening. And we were kind of off to the races with that.
New York lonely boy.
Meredith Scardino is the creator of Girls 5, Ebba, now on Peacock. Thank you for doing this with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brother or sister, just one little mister. He's just another New York lonely boy.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Kat Yore and Paul Smith, who also mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.